fluent in English and funny and able to describe this stuff. And he died in the 90s. Lakshman did. Some of his books here I would recommend as great, warm, and accessible approaches to practice. The Self-Realization book is great as far as practice, and then the Kashmir Shaivism Secret Supreme is great for philosophy. But he talks a little bit about what it, and this is what it looks like to be around somebody who is doing powerful, high-powered practice all the time. And you're getting me, and I'm just a, you know, a cheesehead here. But this is what somebody sounds like when they're really on it. And I think you're gonna, I think you'll can relate to why I think this is relevant to fellow knights. Oh, come on now.
You'll find in each and every individual, but it is in the background. Final goal of in Shaivite philosophy is when individual unites with universal consciousness.
With the universal consciousness, and that universal consciousness
is God.
Is God? Is it in use all the time, Swamiji? You just have to look for it.
No, universal consciousness, you'll find in each and every individual, but it is in the background. Mm-hmm. It is in the subsided state at this time. When you practice and meditate on some point explained by your master, then by and by this individuality vanishes in universality, and time comes when universal consciousness arises in one's own body, and he experiences that universal consciousness, and that is the state of God experience. But that experiencing that universal consciousness is not direct experience.
How do you even know when you're even approaching something like that, Swamiji? What are your signposts on the road?
Memory comes in you.
Memory
comes in you. Oh, I was universal consciousness already previously. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know it.
I see.
This is the sign of that experience.
Memory of past things.
You feel at the time of rising of that universal consciousness in you, you feel there is memory.
As if you've been there before, as if you've felt there before.
Yes.
I see.
Yes.
Swamiji, this superconscious state that you kind of recognize when it hits you, you think, oh, I felt this before. Then what happens? Then what are the signs for a man or a woman into yoga like that? What do they watch for? Where do they go from there?
They don't watch. They feel that consciousness, God consciousness, as the flood and fountains of excessive joy.
Happiness.
Not, it is super sexual joy.
A sexual happiness.
It is not individual sexual joy. It is super sexual joy. Say 100,000 million times more dense joy than that sexual joy.
And it continues a long time.
It continues long time, and it flows in each and every vein of your body. You are intoxicated with that bliss.
And you just feel it over hours and hours or days?
No, it remains only for 3 or 4 seconds, and the rest of life is intoxicated with this.
The rest of your life is affected by that?
If it remains, according to the theory of Ivanov, that if it remains for 1 hour, then this body won't exist.
You die.
Yes.
You die.
Yes.
You cannot sustain.
You cannot tolerate. You cannot tolerate that intensity of joy in this limited body. You have to throw this, shatter this. One with the divine.
Like super sexual joy. It's just such a tremendous joy state. Do yogis go into this feeling when they die? Is this what death is to a yogi?
Yes.
That's why they don't fear it. They love it.
They love death.
And they love death.
They love it.
Thank you. And it's a really sweet little excerpt there. One of the fundamental ideas of tantric practice is that enlightenment is not attained, it is remembered. And there may be some effort to sweep away the flowers from the temple floor, but it's not this great arduous journey. In fact, it sounds obnoxious to those who use other methods, but if meditation is dry and difficult, you aren't doing it right. It's like racing. If it's really slow and hard work at the racetrack, and you don't move very much, you're not doing it right. Start the engine. And you don't have to understand how the engine works, also. Okay, so I want to get into a little bit about how the practices work. Let's see, what have we done? The practices, ski slope metaphor. So here's the problem that Tantra posits. Here's the problem, mechanical problem, to trying to do a meditation, or why it's so hard to do, according to Tantra. And I'm going to give my own analogy. They talk about it's like a mountain. It's like going up on a mountain slope. And I'm going to say it's like a ski slope. Get up here on a ski slope out of your crystal or something like that, right? And it's like this. And it's covered with snow and ice. And I'm up there. And if I move a single muscle, I'm going to go downhill. Everything that I do is going to take me downhill. And this is what the Tantra says, is that the natural flow of energy is towards manifestation from inward, the top of the mountain, self, God, always outward. Will is always expressing itself outward, outward, outward. That's fine. It's not saying outward or inward is good or bad. But if you want to go inward and experience the self, you're climbing up an ice-covered mountain slope. Okay? So basically, what the renunciant paths do is they don't have any technology to go upward. So what do? They balance you. You won't go downhill. You'll stay in one place. And maybe, hopefully, you can slowly cultivate a little bit upward. But there's not a powerful way of, hey, nitrous, ready? Brace yourself. You know, how fast can you tolerate going up the mountain? I mean, this becomes one of the problems with the tantric meditation. Right? Not, can I even get inward and not slip down the mountain? So what is the technology? Well, one of the main tools that Tantra uses is the mantra. And I'm sure you've heard that book that says the mantras and the spells, right? Which is one reason why I think this is relevant to fellows. Mantra is not exclusive to Tantra. Mantra is a tool that comes through Vedic Hinduism and is used by all forms of Hinduism. But Tantra mantra is different. And here's why. Vedic mantra, which is coming from an Osirian culture, there's a particular mantra that is used with each god that you're involved with. So if you want to worship Lakshmi or Vishnu or Hanuman or whoever it is, right, there's a mantra for a Kali, right? There's a mantra that you, and a mantra is a charged word. It's like a, you know, read magic in theory practice and there'll be, you know, Aumann or some, you know, there's this magical word, God name kind of thing. But the idea is the mantra is not a name. It's a tool that you chant and repeat, and as you do that, it forms a layer of energy around you that is the god or goddess. The idea is the mantra is the body of the god or god, and that you're putting it on around you, manifesting when you chant the mantra. And they all usually have meanings, not all of them, some of them, most of Vedic mantras have symbolic meanings that have to do with who they're naming, right? It's like naming a god form. Okay. Now, Tantra doesn't work like that. And the biggest reason why is Tantric mantra does not have a meaning. The words are nonsense syllables, deliberately chosen not to have meanings, because they are a talisman, they are a hollow tube that is then being charged. So what happens is you learn meditation, classically the way you do it, you learn from a teacher, have a little ritual, right? And smells and bells and the ritual and the puja and the presence of the masters and all that good stuff, right? And then they give you a mantra, you say, here it is, your mantra is this word. And it's something, you know, oftentimes, there's a big listen, I see a big listen. And, you know, it's a word sort of like Aum, but not. you know, there's some vowels and some consonants, and it doesn't mean anything. Okay, that's it, and you're given it, and you're taught, don't ever say it aloud, don't ever share it with other people, you go back to your teacher and check, make sure you didn't screw it up. People get worried, oh, I think I messed it up, no, I didn't. But they get worried, so go back to the teacher. But otherwise, you don't say it aloud, which is, again, another interesting parallel to OTO, isn't it? This idea of a charged word that we don't say aloud, right? Okay. So then the idea is, what this word is for is you start out by reciting it silently inside, right? Like, as though you're saying it. And as you do that, because it's charged, it starts to recede. It starts to go deep. And without you having to do any effort, just by paying attention to it, it's like suddenly the depth of the ocean drops out beneath you and you're going deeper and deeper and deeper within. Right? Because the word does it. You don't have to do anything. All you do is pay attention to the word. And then you realize, wow, I was completely distracted there. I completely forgot about the word for a minute. Whoops! And you don't put a black mark in the book. You don't punish yourself. You don't. Those are all renunciant. That's how you crack the whip on your students. You know, discipline. Discipline does not help with tantra. Relaxation helps with tantra. You know, gracefulness, maybe better rather than control. Right? We idolize control and discipline in the West, but you know what? Spontaneity and grace and beauty might be more powerful. Same type code. So what happens is that word goes deep. When you forget, you just, oh, I forgot, turn back to the mantra. Just turn back to the mantra each time. And you can use this with any, it doesn't have to be a tantric mantra. When you're meditating, if you're distracted, so, oh, whoops, and go back to it. Distracted, oh, and you know, you may be some tremendously powerful person who meditates deeply and powerfully, and you go through some really shitty, hard stuff, and you're all upset about it. And you sit down and meditate, and you're thinking, oh, dude, it's really good. Oh, my God. And you get all upset again, and, oh, I remembered again. And, you know, whatever, you know, your ex or your puppy or whatever. I mean, we go through these things, right? Loved ones. All right. Go back to the mantra. Go back to the mantra. Or they're knocking on the door. Oh, by the way, the building is burning down. Then what do? You stop the meditation, and you exit the building. Thank you very much. Right? I mean, there's this whole thing, if the devil wants to disturb your meditation, you wait, I'm meditating now, right? But if it's firemen, go with the nice fireman, right? So that's the idea. And here's another corollary to it, and this, you get to this when you get into powerful practice. What if in the midst of your meditation, you have an epiphany, and then the problem you've been working on, there's the answer to it. What do? Stop meditating, and you pick up your pencil and paper, and you write down your freaking inspiration. That's what it's for. That's why you have a notebook with your meditation. Not to write down how many times you got distracted, but to capture those, right? Because this is how it works. There's one of the people that my teacher was with in the 70s was at a retreat in an ashram in India, and was a yoga practitioner, meditation practitioner, and it happened to be somebody that was a rather professional, but kind of, you know, struggling professional musician in Nashville, you know, had done some session recording and written some songs, had a meditation session, came up with a song, came up with a melody in the meditation, came out of it, wrote it down, left the retreat, went, wrote it down, had it recorded by a top country singer, and retired from the royalties from the song that they got out of their meditation. I know these are like hole-in-one golf stories, right? It's not part of what, it never has happened to me. But this is the idea. That is what is supposed to happen. This is a way of activating and cultivating genius. Also, the idea is that these distractions that happen, you know, every time you turn back to the meditation, you're giving up one little grain of karma. Every little grain of sand at a time. Every time you say, you know what, I'm going to let that go. I was mad at that person, I'm going to let it go, turn back to them. That's very powerful. That's, in fact, beneficial. In fact, breaks are an opportunity to clear out the karma. The goal is not to be somebody who's already perfect. The goal is to get better than how I am. This is the way I look. So this is a different approach, different way of looking at it. about that. You see, and this is all having to do with abundance. Abundance thinking. You've got all the, when you gain some skill, you've got all the general. And the texts say that, you know, originally back in the day, most children would reach a full samadhi experience by age 6. You know, which makes me think that they still do today. We just don't have it culturally over. Because I don't think your children have changed all that much. To tell you the truth. So, okay. We saw Lakshmanju. We have some, I have basically 3 topics left. The last one is I'm going to lead you through some basic meditation practices you can try, some things you can experiment with, take on, plus mess around with, you know, the LBR of Tantra, as it were, stuff you can learn easily and have fun with. I've got a bunch of stuff that is crossover with Thelema that is pretty personal and challenging stuff to talk about the great work and results that I found. The one other thing I was going to talk about is the dark Tantra stuff. I've already referred to it a little bit of the demonology, right? And I'll get back to that. And to the demonology has more to do with, you know, we can leave it off. I don't actually need that anymore. The yoginis. Yoginis are an interesting thing, and they're part of the skeletons in the closet of Tantra. Oh, by the way, Thelema's really cool. Uncle Al did have a heroin problem some of the time. So just so you know, just don't want you to be surprised by this, you know, that kind of thing. Right? It's not a problem for us. We see the picture of that. So it's kind of an analogous thing. So what the yoginis are is yogis, female yogis. Tantra has a tradition, especially before the 8th century, of having come from this tradition of powerful and scary as fuck female yogis, scary Jedi master women, okay, walking around, and yeah. So it's pretty interesting, and you can tell it's remnants of we're all cleaned up now. We're an underclass in the overall Vaishnavite Vishnu culture, but back in the day. So he talks about yoginis in the Tantra Loka, and he talks about them as being heroic figures to be honored with battle heroes and so on and so forth. Okay. Now, yoginis, we understand, are these yoga practitioners, also very sexually powerful women. And the whole idea is, and you see how this relates to the secta cults, is yoginis would wander around, and if you had the good fortune to meet a yogini, and she was interested in you, she might want to do some tantric ritual with you, and that means sex in this case. And great, because this is, wow, you're having this initiatory sexual experience with this phenomenally powerful person. Why were they so feared? Well, okay. So I'm working with a tantra called Nitra. Nitra is the one that is the dark tantra. It's the one that's not in translation. It's the one that includes a bunch of demonology and some various reasons why I'm working with that. But there's a set chapter on yoginis in Nitra, of all places. Nitra is this hot mess of all the wicked stuff, right? And I'm expecting, oh, wow, waka waka, this is going to tell all, this is going to say what the yoginis were doing, right? And it's curious, because they have this, in Nitra, the chapter opens, it's a reverse. Most of the tantras have this form, like Vijnana Bhairava, it's this wonderful form where it's this dialogue between Shiva and the goddess Shakti. And Shiva's giving the answers, and the Shakti, the goddess says, in Vijayana Bhairava, she says, obviously as the power of movement of all the known universe, I already know the answers, but just for fun, tell them to me in limited human terms. And he goes, okay, cool. So in human terms, it goes like this, right? Like she said, I already know it, but just for sport, right? Put it in modern dialectic English, right? Whatever, okay. In this dialogue, it's backwards, and Shiva is asking the goddess questions. He's saying, goddess, why are the yoginis so cruel? Why are they so cruel? And she says, oh, but you understand, it's actually a great blessing that they're conferring upon you. It's actually a great blessing. Yeah, I know it seems cruel, but it's actually, you know, to be initiated so highly is just, you know, the culmination of anyone's life. So now I'm reading tantras that are about the yogini practices through various things. And I'm seeing the tests. Because if you meet the yogini, she tests you to see if you're just some yokel or if you're cool enough to do potent initiatory ritual with it. And there's a bunch of things. Some of them are doctrine. Some of them are like, you have to cup your hands, and then she pours wine into the hands, so you have to drink it and not spill a single drop. Not a single drop. If you spill a single drop, you're done. Okay, stuff like that. And the boy doesn't know it. The boy doesn't see, oh, here, take this test. Tantra Loka has a section on funerary customs. How do you initiate somebody who is dead or dying, or someone who has already died? And they have the idea that once someone has left the body, it's actually a heck of a lot easier to initiate them. In fact, it's a whole lot easier to bring somebody to practically full enlightenment as long as you get them within kind of 2 weeks of their death, because they're still kind of lingering around. Okay. And then it says things like, oh yeah, by the way, and you know, it's interesting because, you know, initiating somebody when they're dead or dying is actually, compared to initiating a live candidate, it's way easier. You could be a relatively crappy guru and get on full enlightenment with somebody because their connections to their body are slipping away. So the yoginis, obviously what's going on is this is an early form of human sacrifice. The yogini would probably slit their throat or ply them with drugs. If they pass the test, then cool, it's a yogi and they have, you know, great tantric sex and they're, you know, both enlightened from it. But there are many discussions in this in the old tantra about saying, yeah, if someone or an animal wanders into your religious festival and just gives themselves up, then you just take it as an indication from the gods that it's a gift. And go ahead and sacrifice them. Oh, and by the way, if there should be any unfortunate deaths at the end of our religious festival, here's where they happen. And I mean, even see today, and there's laws passed in India today that no human sacrifice. How many times do I have to tell you? No human sacrifice. Even if they're willing. Okay. So you see what this yogini tradition was this tradition of initiating a lover as they died. And because they were dying, of the capability of initiating them to a tremendously high level of realization. Which sounds an awful lot like the Templars, Baphomet is a head in the box, right? So you see, Kali, I showed you, I'm going to bother with the picture, you saw these pictures of Kali, right? The modern pictures of Kali are all cleaned up, and she's like standing, you know. She's not riding, straddling atop the corpse of Shiva. What they were doing in the cremation grounds was, I mean, there's texts that describe it. You know, it helps if he's good looking, right? Is they'd find a corpse and do the ritual with the corpse and initiate that person to full levels of realization as Shiva after they were dead, because it hasn't been too long, because this is a cremation ground and there's wagon loads of bodies being hauled in every day and funeral pyres every day. And you know, so sneak in at night and do a ritual with the best looking of the corpses and bring them to full initiation as Shiva. Why are you doing the cremation ground? Because you get busted by the cops if you do that not in the streets anymore. The cremation ground stuff is when the Vaishnavites took over and you couldn't just kill people, even if they said it was okay. You know, so this is why there's this connection of Shaivism with the cremation grounds, because there was that level. And from that, this immensely powerful philosophical meditation tradition. Well, why do you think they had that? Well, because they were learning it from a bunch of yoginis who were talking to Shiva firsthand. You know, effectively, magically speaking. And that's pretty scary stuff. That's nothing I would recommend today, of course. But that's the dark side of Tantra, and that's why there's this weird stuff, and that is why women have this particularly revered and respected role in Tantra historically as the historical, somewhat bloody but quite heroic. You know, they were the ones that really brought the power of the lineage, effectively. Okay. So that's the dark stuff. The demonology stuff gets into the Thelema stuff, and I guess it's time to talk about that stuff. Thank you for listening to me go on at such length. I appreciate it. One of the first questions that I had to ask myself was, what is the word in Sanskrit for angel? Because, okay, you get results, and the first question you ask is, what the fuck is this? Am I kidding myself? And number two is like, okay, I'm not kidding myself, but what is this thing? Is it a thing? Like, you realize, like, another point way of saying it is this culturally constrained? Am I hypnotizing myself as a Thelemite through years of magical practice to believe that someday a voice is going to talk to me and it's going to be an angel and we'll acknowledge a conversational and woo-hoo? And if I've been planning and expecting that for years, if it started to happen, you'd have to ask, wait a minute, am I just like programming myself to do this? This is, again, when it gets back to emic and Edic knowledge. You know, is this a universal human experience, or is this a trick that I program myself to do? You know, I could psychologically, using NLP, I could create a demon to answer questions for me out of my own repressed subconscious, and it would be a psychological thing. That's a different thing from an actual entity that's outside myself. I could do that thing, right? It might even be culturally constrained, and I'd give it names according to my mythology, whatever. But someone who doesn't program themselves to do that, that won't happen. That's not a universal human experience. That's a trick that I did because I did this thing. But what is this thing? So if it is universal, then there ought to be a name for it. And it ought to show up. I mean, geez, the freaking Tantra Loka is 37 chapters. They're the Holy Guardian Angel. You'd think if they knew about it, it ought to show up. So I went looking. And this is why I dove through so many texts so far, and I finally found it. And it was hiding in plain sight. And in order to find it, I had to go pre-Hindu, I had to go pre-Indic, and I had to go back to the Zoroastrian, the Persian, the ancient Persian. It's older than Hinduism, right? Old Persian religion. The old Persian language, the Atharva language, is related to Sanskrit. There's like constant changes. So what I noticed was that And the Zoroastrians are the first, oldest culture that we know of to be talking about angels. Okay, and what you notice right away is that certain cultures have angels, other cultures don't. They're like, there's a difference. They're like, have it, don't have it. Like, very cultural. You think, oh, this is really cultural. And then you notice all the ones that have angels are all monotheistic. The word for angels in polytheistic cultures is God. It's a god you're talking to, a little g, God. Oh, you went in the forest and a god talked to you. Oh, you've got a god that whispers in your ear now, right? Daemon. Okay. So, the Zoroastrians are fascinating, and that could be a whole another topic of conversation. But suffice to say, if you don't know the story, you should know it, because it's the first probably known historical mythological account of someone doing stuff big based on their interaction with angels. And there's a guy named Zoroaster, which means star watcher, and he was the king of that people. Became Zoroastrianism today, Freddie Mercury's religion, right? Monotheistic, really, really monotheistic. But early on, right, they had angels. And Zoroaster had an angel. And about 12,000 years ago, year 9800, according to their records, his angel came to him and said, it's nothing to do with you, but there's war in heaven. The gods are fighting, and the earth is going to die, most of it. And here's what you need to do to save your people. Now, the interesting thing is that geological record we know at that time happened for 1,200 years, the biggest ice age we've had for 400,000 years. It wasn't part of the natural ice receding and coming go. It was because there was a comet called the Lesser Dyad, and it came too close to Earth, and it grazed. The tail grazed the earth. It didn't hit, but the tail grazed the earth, and it got all this ice and dust and crap in the atmosphere, and it was like, you know, volcanic eruption causes catastrophic, you know, climate change. But for 1,200 years, the habitable climate of Earth was reduced down to a third. Humans, animals, everything just died off. Just massive freeze over. So what Zoroaster did is he built these underground cities and led his people to live underground. Some of these cities would house 20,000 people underground, multiple layers. There were tunnels between cities. Some of them are 5 miles long, leading to the next city without ever going above ground. This is, by the way, the first time that people gathered together that we know of in such huge numbers. So it's probably the first time that mystics and shamans ever got together in such large numbers to talk to each other and establish information about anything. And by the way, the Zoroastrian people were known in the ancient, this is before there was Zoroaster, the old word for them in the time of the Greeks was the Magians, the Magi. So in the time of the Greeks, they were like the gypsies. they were always selling magic charms. What do the magi look like? Well, they're wizards with robes with alchemical symbols all over them, because alchemical symbols are all from Zoroastrian, Magian, right? Right. It's like practically everything that we think of as occult that's not Jewish or Greek or Egyptian, almost all the rest of it, except for a very small, interesting resident, but almost everything else is Zoroastrian. The elements, the planets, the symbols, the size of the zodiac, the pointy hats, the just all this stuff about what we think of as occultism today all comes from this. People who gathered together in underground cities for 1,200 years. And after that, they moved back out, the ice receded, and they continued on their way, and the underground cities became catacombs. And they're all over Europe. I mean, you look at Malta, and it's like, boy, that looks really like what you see in Iran. So basically, there's this ancient history of these people whose trajectory was altered by their leader having a dialogue with an angel and leading them accordingly. Now, interestingly enough, there's this the ancient Persians, I'm going to call them, ancient Persians, the Magians, have a bunch of stories. By the way, the difficulty with them is they didn't have written language, right? So it's all come down through a world tradition of distortion, so it's really easy to say, ah, those gypsies are all liars, kind of thing. But not so. Okay. But they describe something that the Hindus also, the proto-Hindus, because Hinduism, anything before 1300 BCE isn't even Hinduism. It's something else. It's earlier. It's Vedic. It's old times. They both describe a time when the earth was overrun with this big problem, overrun with demons, and that there was this great war between gods and demons. And they go into detail about it, and they talk about the nature of them, and who they are, and what they are, and what their names are. And they're basically, they say, yeah, there's just like humans. They're not good or evil per se. It's just that some of them are nasty, and some of them are nice, and some are on our side, and some are on the other side. The good ones we call Ahura. It's the old Magian word for angel, Ahura, right? The word for demon is, and they say, oh, you know, and they're the same thing, it's just a bad one, is Deva, from which we get the word devil, also known as the Sanskrit word for God, right? The Sanskrit word for devil is Asura, because H becomes an S when you go from Atharva to Sanskrit. So you get the Indians and the Persians both talking about a battle between gods and demons, and they are using the same word for them, except switched around, our gods are their demons, and their demons are our gods. Okay, and then when I looked into that, then it became, okay, where does this come up? Where do Hindus encounter this? Well, they're taught from, it's called Ishtadeva. When you're a child, every child, just like a Catholic child has like a patron saint, Hindu children are given a favorite, Ishta means favorite god. You're given a certain form, just like you might say, oh, it's safe for you, it's St. Michael or St. Bartholomew or St. Gabriel or whatever, like archangelic kind of metaphors, right? And so every child has a little altar in their room to their favorite god that then they can look to, little pujas, little offerings to, and stuff like that. So they are brought up from an early age having this personal, emotional relationship with a guardian god who is their personal deva. Right? The Tantraloka talks in some detail about how initiation takes place. And initiation means a very specific thing. Guru means actually a very specific thing. And this is also a difference where the term guru is used differently by the Assyrians, because it's all this thing about discipline and obedience and all this. And the Tantra is like, let's just talk about the teacher. But it's an initiator. Basically, the idea is a very profound initiation. The guru teacher connects their energy to that of the student and then raises their own kundalini and induces the student's kundalini to rise as well. And there's an initiatory function. And they talk about how this happens, and there's a number of many chapters about how this is done. By the way, when humans do this, it's such an intimately personal thing that oftentimes the teacher will actually adopt the student as their son or daughter at that point. They're so deeply connected at that point. You know, it's not just, hey, we're gonna teach everybody who comes walking in the door. That's a very, very profound high-level initiation that can then bring full realization. What does full realization look like? In Tantra, it's talked about as capacity. It's not just, okay, you reach samadhi because everybody could do that, and you hope you can remember it and hang on to it a little bit, but can you keep your realization in the midst of distraction? Can you meditate in the middle of a crowded street? Can you keep your awareness of universal consciousness while enduring devastating personal emotional news? You know, It takes capacity. And when we start out, we can get a little bit of spark, but oh man, life is also really tough. As you get stronger and stronger, eventually you get to where your meditation is not disturbed by noises in the street or people. You can meditate anywhere, anything you want. In fact, you go to meditation as a refuge and a rejuvenation that allows you to deal with all these very difficult things. And at a certain point, you simply gain so much capacity, it's said, that nothing in your life will ever, ever dislodge you from that awareness. Nothing can touch it. You're just so firmly, practicedly rooted in that you're just there all the time. And people like that, we call them saints, and you just feel it in the room. I'm not like that yet, or before possibly, but that is what the scale from the beginning practice to enlightenment. That's what it looks like. You just gain more practice. So, hey, even if you're a relatively newcomer, you can have a profound experience. You can have an awakened experience. It's just that you might not be able to keep that in mind while all these other things are going on. So that takes practice. That's what it looks like. Remember how I said there were the classes of practice, the body practice, the mind practice, the neither practice, and then the no practice at all? So all the Patanjali yoga, all the stuff like that, that's body practice in this system. In all the Vedanta and all the visualization, there's all the Jnana yoga and stuff like that, wisdom yoga. That's all mind practice. Sambhava, the unsupported practice, it's just in Tantra, it's not anywhere else. I haven't found anywhere else. Because there's nothing you can say about it, if you don't have the structure for understanding what that is, that's where it just like gets spooky. I mean, that's where the spook comes in, the spook factor comes in. I work with somebody who's a really hot shaman, you know, and they're like, hey, okay, here we go. And then suddenly the spook factor comes up, you know, where it's like, well, there's nothing you can say about where that came from or how they did that. Well, that's Sambhava, that's Turiya mind. That's that third level. So it creeps in, but there's no system for achieving that except Tantra. So imagine my surprise when I'm getting those freaking Sambhava results, talking to my teachers. This can't possibly be right. No, that's it. Lakshmanju talks about this super sexual energy. That's the rising of the Kundalini. It is an intensity that is like the intense feeling of sexual feeling, but instead of just one area of your body, it is your entire body, and you lose sense of your body entirely. With the same intensity, just it's very profound. And like he says, you can only handle it for a few seconds at a time, come back out of it, surf it, you know, integrate that into what you're doing. So that's what that's about. Angels. Tantra Loka says that you can get initiations from several different sources. You can get it from a human teacher. Some people just have it. They say get it from Shiva, which means they're just born with it. Some people get it from dead masters, right? There's a guy in India right now, he's like one of the big leader in India right now, who has gained his realization, he says, from having dreams where Muktananda appeared. Muktananda's been dead, 45 years, right? So this dead teacher appears to him and teaches him, initiates him, and says, now you go forth and do this, and he is. Okay, that's how it works. That's one of the ways it works. That's not considered unusual at all in this system. And another way is devas. So then we get to the word that I think that we are interested in as Thelemites. You know, what is that angel that is not just an angel, but your guardian angel? What is that? Well, it appears to be Guru Deva. Not to be confused with Guru Dev, because people will call their human guru Guru Dev as like, you know, oh divine teacher, oh divine initiator, you're so fucking cool, I'm gonna call you a god even though you got DNA and you're breathing over there. You know, but that's a different thing from saying there's a still small voice in your ear that's now talking to you and giving advice and teaching you and as your initiator. And that's what they're talking about. And I have talked with some heavy people at Tantra and said, is this, and pretty much. And there's a bunch of the stuff that's done, a bunch of the practices and the training that's done, as it turns out, that looks like it's done for the purpose of the person's angel, not necessarily the person himself. And, you know, there's this whole idea that we get into. It's like, okay, well, if people have holy guardian angels, does everyone have one? Are they all, like, some people don't seem to, like, some of them are awake and some of them are asleep. Like, what is the deal? Like, some have it and some don't. And I'll tell you my working model. for what it's worth, I think they're the hive mind of the mitochondria. I think it's a conscious entity. I think it's a separate species. I mean, I raise bees. I know what 20,000 bees in a hive could do. It's a pretty interesting consciousness there. I mean, there's millions of mitochondria in our cells, and not only are they in every cell, they're in every nerve connection. Not just every neuron, there's mitochondria in every nerve connection. They are there and able to sense every single time any nerve connection fires from the inside. They are the electrical source. And they have their own DNA, they're their own species. I mean, mitochondria, I mean, that's one thing. They're not humans. They're a form of bacteria or a form of microorganism. That's why animal cells can move, because they've got mitochondria. Mitochondria convert chemical to electrical energy and allow things like muscle tissues and stuff like that. That's why plants can't move. So, like, all right, so if that evolves with no mechanism to talk to us directly, except being inside our brains, well, that could evolve a pretty interesting danger sense. You know, if you're an animal, if you're a primate, early proto-human in the jungle, and you wake, it's like, wake up, get out now, get out, wake up, walk away, get away now. And you're like, okay, and you do, and then the tiger comes through, you know, stuff like that, because that's the kind of predictive stuff that's associated with these things. So that could very easily evolve as a kind of guardian sense, and also a sense of intuition about how to help other people and how to give other people what they need. I know a number of people who work as psychics who are basically working with angels, working with their own angels or other spirits, and they say, you know, and I mean, I know about them because they have phenomenal track records. You know, friends of mine have gone to see some of the psychics in the area, walked in, didn't tell the person anything, and the psychic said, okay, so the problem is with your cousin, and what you don't know is your cousin's been doing this, and this is why this is going on, this is why you're feeling. I'm like, how do you even know this stuff? And it's like, well, the psychic says, I'm not reading their mind. My angel talks to their angel, find out what's going on. My angel tells me. And that's how it works. And I hear a lot of that process as far as people using that as a psychic healing kind of thing. So it seems like there's that stuff going on. I will say also, I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but there's a growing number of people who are, I'm going to call natural seers, who are appearing around and, there's kind of been a division in the occult world because, of course, at the time of Agrippa, they were all outlawed. The whole thing about natural magic was the idea that it was okay to do magic if it was elements and earth, air, water, fire, and, you know, that's all God's creation. But if you're talking to spirits, that could be evil and wicked because spirits are, you know, tricksy. So there was a certain point where any kind of seership or mediumship or interaction with entities was specifically banned. And you can see that because after that it doesn't show up in the magical text. Or it does, but as, you know, as Galatian. So anyway, so where does that leave us? I found the tantric meditation practice to be extremely helpful for this kind of work. I see this kind of work, I see three things that have to happen for this kind of work, and meditation is good for part of it. Meditation is very good for raising your energy. You know, the more you, as you learn to get that source of bliss, get that source of energy, becomes something that your energic sense is like. If you want to raise your energy, just sitting here, how do you turn it up as high as you want to? Well, as a magician, you know how to do that. Then the other things you need to do is, once your energy is raised, you've got to clear the room. You've got to master your own internal demons. You know, this is an Abra Melon where they talk about, you know, after you've done the successful invocation, you go and you bind all the demons. Because if you don't, what happens is your own internal bullshit, if you're letting your bad mood road rager inside you still run around and be a brat, right? Once you start talking to angels, that road rager will just get so energized and worked up that not only will they keep you off center, but they'll set off everyone else around you. And this is the whole thing of, you know, you exit the temple and suddenly everyone is like this demon who's, you know, wants your blood, right? They aren't real. Abramelin demons aren't real. They're a phenomenon where I am so off center that I'm ticking everyone else off from 50 feet away before they even see me. They come in the room and they're ticked off because the energy is so hot. So when you get these energy, these results, you have to learn to quiet them down. You guys, stay behind me. Shut up. Tap me on the shoulder. You want to be my muses. Internal demons can be muses, but they got to tap me on the shoulder and shut up when I tell them to. Okay, then that's okay. that also becomes important, because if you're talking to voices, one of the questions is, am I just hearing my own voice? And the analogy is like, well, let's say you see a dog running in the street two blocks away. There's a dog way up there in the street. Is that your dog? Oh, is your dog running loose? Like, no, it's not my dog. My dog's right here. I've got my dog. I know who that is. It's not my dog. My dog is quiet. I'm hearing this voice. I don't know whose voice it is. It ain't mine. Because I could quiet. That becomes really important to do in meditation, and to have positive ability to do that, and know what it is, know when you're doing it and when you're not doing it. The third thing to do is aiming. And I'm not going to get into it here, but I think every magician knows, you know, aiming at what it is, who it is you want to talk to, and what it is that you're, rather than just wandering around and whoever wants to talk to you. Okay. Well, let's get into some practices. Thank you. Any questions about all this stuff before? Any stuff you want to? Yeah.
You mentioned earlier about some practices that don't work, and you described that, to approach them the way that they're described
right.
cancels them out. That right. was pretty clear.
Right.
You also mentioned that there are some that are harmful. By harmful, right. do you mean that they're just...
They're harmful to householders.
Okay.
You know, basically the idea is, and this is the idea of Kali Yuga, right? You guys have heard of Kali Yuga, these ages in Hinduism. By the way, Kali Yuga is not named after the goddess Kali. It's a different A. It's a different letter. It's Kali, not Kali. It's Kali Yuga. Kali is the goddess. It's different. It'd be like God and Gud. You know, nobody would mistake it. But the idea is in Kali Yuga, everything is reversed. And Kali Yuga is Osiris, the name of Osiris, when all the monks are adopting tantric practices. They're adopting householder practices because they're more powerful. And then they're turning around and teaching monastic practices to the householders. You want to learn yoga? Here, chant Om. Here, do these Buddhist practices that are meant to separate your body from your mind. Practices that separate your body from your mind are good if you are a monastic, if you really are a renunciate. If you really do are somebody who says, you know, I want to negate myself. I just want there to be God. Okay, if that's your will, if that's your true will, I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. But the practice that works for you then to negate yourself is not the practice you would give to a householder. It's a little bit analogous in my mind to saying, I mean, householders doing renunciate practices, so it's a little bit like a Thelemite doing, I don't know, some like, you know, Christian Jesuit practice where you imagine being Jesus on the cross or something. You know, visualize being crucified, like, that might make sense of a Christian, but like I just wouldn't advise that to a Thelemite. I just think that's going the wrong way. I just don't think that's taking you. Now, you know, if there's a person that feels like that's where their path is, fine. But that's not what you want to teach Thelemites in general. And in the same way, you don't want to teach householders to do yoga practices that are meant for monks. Because the monks aren't doing them anyway. They're doing the householder practices, because the householder practices work better. So this is the idea, is that during the Kali Yuga, you're taught that you are not God, right? And you have a higher self, but it's not you. And, oh, but your angel is just your higher self. Don't listen to him. It's just yourself. And God is outside you, and you should obey. And here, do these practices. They're meant for monks that will be destructive to you. Meanwhile, the monks are doing the household practices. So Kali Yuga, everything is reversed. Everything's upside down. And it's chaos. However, that is not the last yuga. The Vaishnavites think it is. The Syrians think it is. Just like, you know, the Christians think Revelations is the end of the world. It's like, well, no, maybe it's just the doorway, right? The yuga that comes after Kali Yuga is called Siddha Yuga, and it is the age of wisdom. It is the age of enlightenment. It's the age when magic and empowerment is available to everybody, and that's the idea. And it's rough. I mean, the transition is rocky out there. There's a lot of rockiness out there with people making the transition. A lot of yoga people who have been very embedded in very renunciate practices. You got to understand, India doesn't just encourage like asceticism. It glamorizes it. It fetishizes. I mean, Indian culture is so like the noble ascetic who gives everything. Like that's just the coolest thing in the world. So even to say, you know, no, I mean, go into to joy and bliss and you know, make babies. It's like it's completely the opposite direction. So that's it's hard. Thank you for calling me out on that. It's harmful for us, I think. And oh, yeah, so here's one of the things that just made me laugh out loud, right? So there's a section in Tantra Loka where he's talking about, okay, be really careful who you teach, because the karma of the student is visited on the teacher. If you take on a student and they murder somebody, you as a teacher are going to now share in that karma. Okay, you're connected that much. So be careful. So then what do you do if someone who wants to be taught and they're a murderer? What if they're a criminal? What if they're a fuck-off? What if they're lazy? What if they don't do the practices? Worst of all, what if they're a foreigner? Even worse than that, what if they're a Buddhist? Right. Oh, okay, then what you do, he said, okay, so then, said, you have to give them something. Give them something that's probably good for them, but they're not going to get into any trouble with it and is guaranteed not to give them any results. And then guess what he describes? He describes yoga pretty much as Crowley describes it. Big emphasis on asana, big emphasis on pranayama, making a big, big show about, oh, there's you know, you change the rhythm and the long and short and how many breaths in and out. And he said, yeah, get them all hung up in the counting the breaths because, you know, it's impossible to actually even make that work. The only way to make the breath work for the tantrics is to observe the breath without watching it. Because you literally can't balance it well enough to make that work, so you're giving them something that is... And I'm just like, holy crap. This is what they gave the Buddhists. Crowley learned yoga from a Buddhist. He was a British civil servant, right? He was a former director of Ceylon or something like that. And it was Buddhist yoga. So it's like, oh. So, you know, I'm not here to knock down Uncle Al, but I do believe that, I mean, the reason I got involved with Crowley and Flynn in the first place was that he was really aiming at, it was the goals, not the means. The goal is the spiritual growth of people and learning these tools and figuring them out. It isn't to say, hey, we're going to preserve the particular set that he thought was the only thing that, I mean, you know, if you've got no yoga at all, it's good stuff. Hey, great, cool. But it deserves to be, you know, it's an ongoing research process is the way that I view it. And not everyone does. There is also a tradition that says, hey, we're here to preserve the tradition, we're here to preserve how it was done at that certain thing in time, because it's what we're devoted to. Great, that's not my thing. Yeah?
Everything that you were saying about Shiva and the Yogini,
yeah.
Reminding me of festivals of Dionysus and Maenads, and I'm curious if you can speak to any sort of parallel crossover.
There's got to be. I mean, I think it's probably describing the same thing. I mean, I think what happens is as you go back 2,000 or 3,000 years, a lot of this stuff crossed over a lot. You know, and it's also getting over there in the polytheistic realm as well. I mean, I don't know. I'm not a scholar of those areas. I would certainly hate to make the mistake of saying, oh yeah, the Maenads are they came from the yogi. Who could tell? You know, that's one of the things that I really appreciate in Samuel's book, is he does point out a bunch of the stuff that, you know, hey, at a certain point, we really can't know. We can know some things, but we can also see the edge of, like, you know, you see the images of Rudra, the from the Mohenjo-daro, the early Harappan seals that are those ancient horned god images. We assume that's Shiva, and Samuel points out, he said, we cannot assume that. That could be wrong. I will say that the thing that opened my eyes for thinking about the ancient world was to say, okay, what if there was a period in which, maybe not politically, people say, well, you know, the idea of matriarchal ancient world is really, you know, a myth. Okay, great, but what if there was the attitude? Look at how shitty we are to women today. Look at 1950s. Look at women in the movies. You know, you've got Godzilla, you've got King Kong, you've got the hero who's got a name, and you've got girlfriend, right? And she doesn't even have a name in that movie, right? And it's like, but she's an incarnation of the eternal goddess for every man, and so she'll be okay with not having an identity because she's that universal thing, right? And it's like, well, that's bullshit, right? But what if you go back to a time of 12,000 years ago when people were living in underground cities, and living by cultivating animals. Anybody here grown up on a horse farm? I grew up on a horse farm. Who do you got on a horse farm? Gender-wise, the horses. Mares are great. Female horses are great. Male horses? Geldum. Right? Stallions? You keep one stallion on a horse farm for one reason. Because otherwise they're just too much of a fucking pain in the ass. They'll be fighting, they'll be causing all this trouble. So what do? You geld them all. You got geldings and mares. And one stallion for breeding purposes. So in a matriarchal society, I think the horned god was Mudflap Girl. No, I really do.
Awesome.
I really do. And you know, so and it's interesting because you see this phenomenon of like local god forms sort of being absorbed into regional, you know, local variations being absorbed into regional and then local. It's like individual forms of Lakshmi under different names, and they merge into this sort of, this county has this form, and this, and they all kind of merge, right? But we know that hierarchy family tree of all the individual local goddess names that merged into that uber goddess that we know as the great goddess, right? Well, they say the same thing happened with the gods, Ganesh. Interestingly enough, we don't have their names. The names of the boys wasn't kept. The names of the girls... Don't you have a wedding and forget to invite one of the witches? The boys. So if I just say the theory, what if we were shitty to men back then as we're shitty to women now? And then suddenly an awful lot makes sense. The heroic Yoginis, the fact that men were recruited into these armies and butchered by the, you know, hey, march her armies off and fight them. Holy crap. So that, I mean, this is just you know, speculative, but that's where I'm at with some of that ancient stuff in the yoginis. But Kali is definitely an image of the yoginis. I think that's why she's got the skulls. That was last week, and this is this guy. Well, but imagine that, and what if you could talk to your god anytime you wanted and get any question answered you wanted accurately by actually talking to your god? Okay, well, you get a lot done then, I guess. So I think that's why the skulls are sort of empty in this sense. But, you know, what do I know in the right way? Other questions about this stuff? I really appreciate you guys going on this bizarre journey of my synthesis. You see where I'm going with this as a form of Tholemic Tantra, really. Because Thema Lehman has all the perfect ethical stuff, and this stuff gives a lot of technical stuff, and there's really not any conflict per se. It's just... Okay, should we talk about a little bit about practice? Okay. All right. So one of the things, I've got this handout here, and there's some diagrams on it. One of the things that's interesting is that the chakras do come through Tantra, and particularly Nath developed a bunch. They also come, they have their roots in Taoism. But the Tantra talks about a different system of chakras. You see, I can put up a projector, but you don't need to read the words, but you see that little diagram does not look like the chakra diagram that you normally see. Some of them are the same and some of them are quite different. For instance, the genitals are lower on the Kundalini tree than Muladhara, and yet they're also higher physically in front, so that that there's a curl at the bottom. Interestingly enough. Also, the crown chakra is certainly not the last chakra. There are chakras above that. There are also a number of more detailed chakras across the skull and the brow, and then succeeding up above the head. But these are not things that you normally use. The Tantra doesn't really use the chakras for the meditation practice. It's something that emerges back out as a result. Like you might feel a result of what you do in a particular area, but most of the time it's not what you're focusing on. There's kind of this idea that just in the same way that you can't orgasm yourself to enlightenment, you can't visualize yourself that way either, that there's something else that has to happen. So what I want to teach you is from the Vijnana Bhairava, and it's interesting because it shows up in very different ways. It says that there are different points. I like how Lakshman Shu says, yeah, you're meditating on some point taught to you by your teacher. And you think, oh, some philosophical point. No, I don't think so. I think he's saying your teacher gives you a physical point in space to meditate on. So I'm going to give you one. It's called the Dvadasanta point. Dvadasanta means 12 point, and it's 12 fingers in front of your nose. In other words, three hands. It's right there. So what you do is you just place your awareness on it. Just be aware of it. Okay? For a second, for a moment, for a minute. This is something you could do throughout the day. And there's a chapter in the Jnanabhairava that says, just placing your attention on this briefly at occasional moments throughout the day will help to cultivate and sort out and is beneficial in various different ways. A little more involved version of it is used for lucid dreaming as well, curiously enough. You're reading this 10th century text that's giving you instructions on how to do lucid dreaming, right? Very curious. So the idea is that you focus on the Dvadasanta point, and as you breathe inward and outward, think of your breath coming in from that point, going in, and then going back out. Observe the breath, but without controlling it. This is a very important point. The inward and the outward breath are the two side serpents, right, the Ida and the Pingala. And the idea is to get them perfectly balanced, and the trouble is you can't balance them consciously, but nature will balance them for you. If you let your breath go naturally, they will balance out. At a certain point, when they are perfectly balanced, then the kundalini starts to rise. But so to start with, imagine that point, and take a moment, eyes closed or eyes open if you want, and as you breathe in, imagine that flow of breath coming in, that point is held to be the point at which your subtle energy, your prana, anapana, enter and leave the egg. So that's the entrance and exit point of your subtle ethereal body right there at that point. So you're imagining breathing in and breathing out. And it's a little bit like, the reason we look at breath, because breath isn't subtle energy, but it flows with it. So it's like if somebody didn't know there was air, and they didn't know there was wind, like wind, air, there's nothing there. What are you talking about? You say, see that tree blowing in the wind? And if you imagine that there's an invisible thing that's pushing on those things. And, oh, okay, then I can start to imagine that there's wind. Right? So as you pay attention to your breath, you start to, by imagining your breath, you start to become aware of the apana, inward, and prana, outward energy flow. So that's a good one to do. Now, I'm kind of just zooming you right through these really quickly. I'm going to sort of give these to you, and you can take them off and meditate within the practice of them. And we'll do a little bit of meditation for a minute here just for fun. But the next step with that is another point within the body, and it's not part of the normal chakra system. It's called the Hridya, which means heart. But it's not the heart chakra. It's not the Anahata chakra. It is the inward self. It is, if you sort of imagine, any D&D players in here, remember a bag of holding? Bag that's like, right, bigger on the inside than it is small, right? Imagine that there's that just below, at or below your diaphragm, such that there's just as there's that much distance from the Dvadasanta point in, now there's equally much distance in that inward cave of the heart. With meditation is when you work with Hridya, as you silence your body mind, you lose your sense of these things being fixed in your body like it's down here, and you find yourself looking inward. You find yourself looking inward, and some of the things that you see oftentimes are a spot
or something that looks like cabbages, or something that looks like a rose. Another thing that you'll sometimes see is something that looks like pearl. The blue pearl is another one of the forms. So this is something that, emerges out of those things. Also often, if you're doing it well, there'll be this intense sense of bliss and joy, and you get the smileys. I don't know if that's what you're smiling at, but...
Cabbages.
Oh, yeah, cabbages, yeah. No, this green cabbage, right, and the heart. So that's one of the components. So then, finally, there's one more component that I want to give you, and that is I'm going to give you a mantra that you can use with these. Now, this is an unusual mantra in that it is not initiated. I'm not trained or authorized to initiate anybody in the practice that I learned. I learned an initiated mantra that was charged by my teacher. There is a mantra that is automatically self-charging, and we can say it out loud, so it's not like one of those initiated mantras. And yet, dang, it works. It may not be, you know, a nitro hemi race motor, but it motors right along. And in fact, it's used in some of the texts as a placeholder in ritual where the actual secret word would go, and they use this word as a placeholder because it works for it. It's just lower energy. The word is hamsa, and it has three parts. There's ha, which is the Sanskrit word for in, and sa, which is the Sanskrit word for out, and then in between the m, which means just like it does in Hebrew or English, whatever, is associations with the mother. Right. So you got sa. So you imagine, focus on the breath. Imagine the breath coming in from the Devadasanta as you think ha. And at that pause point where it just pauses for a second, that's the and then it goes as it goes back out, that's sa. So it's sa. Okay. And why this works, we'll sit and do this for a minute and do a little meditation and we'll call it a day. Why this works is hamsa is the word it means Sanskrit, it means swan. And it's a symbol of the soul. But what it's really for is it's connecting the power of your breath to your meditation. At a certain point, what happens as you meditate, these mantras will recede. At another point, what also happens is they stop being wordy. They stop seeming like letters or words. They sort of melt, and they become a feeling or a sound or a touch. Or, you know, I started with this word and I sort of still have my finger on it, but now it just feels like a bump, or it feels like a place in my mind, or it feels like something different. And that's fine. It's still the mantra. And what you'll notice is as you get familiarity with it, is it'll come back to you that way. Because, oh, I was meditating all along. I was universal consciousness already. I forgot. Oh, that's so freaking cool. Shiva loves that. But, oh, dude. That is called out in the text as the emotion that Shiva loves. That's the remembrance that, oh, totally, right? So that's what that's for. With Hamsa in particular, once you work with it enough, you'll realize that if you want it to be, it can be going on all the time during your breath. Right? As you breathe in, as you breathe out, your body is doing Hamsa, and you're getting that energy, you're getting that purification of the prana anapana. Now, it's not something that's out of your control. If you don't like this and don't want to do it, say screw that stuff and it's gone. But if you practice with it and adopt it, goes, oh, I can have this. This can be working for me like a little water wheel pump that's working and increasing my energy and working off the karma all the time. So, good? Okay, let's do just a little bit of meditation. What I'd like to do is sit for just like maybe 1 or 2 minutes is all. The other thing I want to say with meditation is that I realize that a lot of the instructions that come across are designed with one set of instructions for everybody. If you have to have one set of instructions for everybody, that isn't going to be one size fits all. It isn't going to fit everybody perfectly. The instructions are usually meditate for 10 minutes at a time in the morning and the evening. It's a good transition from sleeping to waking. It's a good transition to waking to sleeping. But, oh, and also the tradition says that the hour before sunrise and before sunset are phenomenally more powerful. If you want to supercharge your practice, set your alarm and get up an hour before dawn. And this is true with any practice, but that's a particularly important time. Okay, what I'm going to do is I'll sit and we'll sit and we'll do this meditation together. And as we do this, I'm going to go ahead and jump forward into some of the more advanced meditation stuff that I do. And I'm just telling you that because it's probably what we do. I mean, how many meditation teachers are out there, I'm going to be really honest with you, charging money for meditation classes, and we'll all sit and we'll all give you some secret word like Om. Okay, you kids all sit and meditate on Om, and I'm going to sit up here and I'm going to invoke some lightning bolt practice and get some major energy going on, and all the meditation students go, oh, it was wonderful, I sat with my teacher and I got so energized. Yeah, it's because they're sitting up there doing stuff. And then that stuff is going on. I'm just telling you that. So you guys try the Hamsa, observing the breath. I'll do it with you, and then I'm going to jump into that. And, you know, you guys are magicians, so you may feel some of that. I think when we all do group ritual together, we can feel a little bit more. So maybe get a little boost from that, and then we'll call that good. And then I'll close with a salutation. Shiva, O great universal consciousness, appear as an ocean of friendliness. Jaya, Jaya, Kuruna De Shri. Stop focusing on the mantra. Take your time opening your eyes. Take a minute. There's one thing that I meant to mention, and it's a good thing to close with. I saw the pictures of Shiva at the beginning, and one of the things that they used as an altar is these shivalingas, these stones, right? And it means phallus, but it really isn't a sexual thing. It's more way of visualizing core. And the interesting thing is the stones, the rounded ones, are not carved. They're rolled in the water. There's the rocks fracture at a certain angle to create those long shapes, and then the river rolls them so that those natural forms arise as a force of nature and not as a force of any human hand. And there's a natural beauty to those and a natural organic quality that's very, very deeply powerful. And so as an altarpiece or as a meditation tool, if you have one of those shivaling of stones, you can place your awareness on the shivaling of stone. And as your body mind quiets down, you may feel like you're inside this stone and it just becomes this giant giant universe, just cool depths that you plunge into as a sort of like a cat in a box. It's a happy in a box, they feel their own boundaries. Kind of gets them. So one of the things I wanted to bring up for you guys is these stones are from a river in India. They are not carved by humans, that's why they're all different. And you can each take one if you want. You don't have to, but you can each take one. And if you ever want to, you put that in your ritual, on your altar, or use it as a meditation tool, you're welcome. That's it, and thank you very much for listening to my long discussion.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you. You can understand why I just, I run across these things, and I'm like, holy crap. From divided for love's sake, for the chance of union, just so many parallels, striking parallels.
How do you relate to energies that come up in practice that are maybe a little bit difficult? Because normally, teaching and meditation is like if you have some kind of irritation or nervousness or things that make the kind of energies that make practice difficult mm-hmm. to settle down, the instruction is usually, let that go. Yeah. But I've heard of other practices of, utilizing those energies mm-hmm. or kind of moving with them or against them.
Okay.
Those defilements have a positive side to them sometimes in Tantra.
Right, you can use them, right. And Tantra talks about using pleasure as a means, but also talks about using pain as a means, and it says, yeah, it's not as much fun, but reality is sometimes we deal with pain. So there is one of the practices, and I mentioned this. I'm writing a book on meditation, and if you guys want a copy of it, need a copy of the manuscript, I'd be glad to share it with you. There's a section in there that I've included that I'm calling recovery practices, that are in the Bhairava, that are practices for people that are too disturbed or too upset to meditate. They're in too much pain, too can't concentrate, too anxious, and whatever. And there's a number of them. And it says, this isn't going to do everything for everyone. This isn't the ultimate thing, but it may be the best that you can do with considering. One of them is specifically for pain. And what it does is it says, focus on the sensation of the pain. And I was reading this. I had some root canal work to do, right? And I was reading this text, and then I went and tested with the root canal work. Focus on the sensation of the pain and not the thought or the perception of the cause of the pain, but merely on the pure sensation. And I found that opened up and that enabled me to deal with that and to be present with that, and it transformed it for me. I have a story about that actually from one of the beta testers from my meditation book who, I should have probably had some kind of waiver, but there's somebody who was testing it who has had a history of some heart conditions and will get I don't know medical terms. There's a thing that happens with heart palpitations where your heart will start beating too fast. People get that for various, like, they'll have a stress response, and then their heart will just, like, beat out of control, and, then either it stops or it cramps and they die, right? And so this person had an attack of that and had read the book with the recovery practices that says focus on the location of the pain and the sensation and not the perceived cause. And so they did on the pain in their heart muscle as they were lying on the floor wondering if they were going to die. And by doing that meditation, it made it stop. Slow down, go back to normal. Not what the text says it's for, but holy crap. So, so there's definitely, there are some practices that are designed for people who've been traumatized by war. Somebody who has been so, had such a fearful experience that they've just freaked out, run away, and now they're just freaking out, and there's practices for them. So there's a bunch of different ones. In general, it's turned back to the mantra. What I find for me, the mantra practice is powerful enough that I can get this fountain of bliss, like he says, get this upwelling of that sensation, and I can use that oftentimes to help me balance whatever is bothering me and help me feel like I can get back to my centered self. And then, And then, okay, well, see, they're building up the good and the bad of it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, and if you meditate on the Vanasanta Hum video while you're asleep, that's what you need to do. Pretty interesting. Or
yeah, we might as well just leave the setup, yeah.
So your description of Chula's sleep kind of reminds me of using